want to explicitly be political, but we also have to understand that we don't exist in a vacuum. And that,
that is very true. Yeah.
The political history influences our expression, does it not?
Definitely. I think that the whole reason how hip hop developed and how, like, largely African American culture and music developed was the fact that, you know, they were sort of excluded. And my, you know, my approach is that what if these people actually had sort of resources in the beginning? We would have created personalities like Josephine Defre or like J.S. Bach, you know, like we, I mean, not that, not to, I'm not saying to like discredit or, you know, disrespect all this masters of the genres, but I'm just saying they just suffered a lot and then created this beautiful jewels, like, you know, Pearl, you know, and I think that the expression is so potent and universal, and there's evidence for it. I liked it. I couldn't even understand what they were saying. And then I was like, wow, like, second track after Police. Oh my God, these guys, who are these guys?
You right.
So yeah.
Well, why don't you let the people know the time and date and the location for your show in Portland?
So we're going to be performing at Star Theater on September 6th at 8 p.m. And you can find all the information at miknowoj.com. That is miknowoj.com.
It's been great talking to you, Juwan, and I'm going to look forward to catching up with you when you're in Portland.
Have you entered the KBOO Fall Membership Drive Sweepstakes? The grand prize is a trip to Busurias, Mexico, including $1,000 in airfare and a week's worth of lodging at Casa Tranquila. Other prizes include a Portland Center Stage Flex Pass, hundreds of dollars to Grand Central Bakery, and health and wellness packages at Evolution Healthcare and Fitness. We have raised over $10,000 at this time to help shorten the fall membership drive. Remember, for every $15,000 we raise before September 9th, we will take one day off our fall membership drive. A donation is not required to enter the sweepstakes. For more info, visit kboo.fm/2015fallsweeps. And thank you to everyone who has donated early to the fall membership drive.
Tune into KBOO every weekday at 7 p.m. for Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective with Davey D. Hard Knock Radio features in-depth interviews and profiles with community leaders, activists, hip-hop artists, and musicians, giving voice to community concerns and offering a unique forum to explore issues relevant to hip-hop community. That's every weekday at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, and welcome to another edition of From the Vault, our weekly series that takes the history out of the oldest and largest collections of public radio programming in the United States and puts it back on the radio. On this edition of From the Vault, we look at one of the early actions of the civil rights movement, 23-year-old Joseph Jackson Jr., who together with eight fellow students were known as the Tupelo Nine and made national headlines on March 27, 1961, when they broke the Jim Crow law by entering the white-only Maine Public Library in Jackson, Mississippi.
The moment we stepped in that library, all I know in terms of what I felt, when I saw the expressions of those faces on those white people, I mean, it was a hush. I mean, looking at the expression, they was frightened. They didn't know how to handle it other than to reach for the phone and to call the Jackson Police Department.
Joseph Jackson Jr. was elected youth council president for the local chapter of the NAACP while he was a student at Tougaloo College, the all-black Christian school in Jackson, Mississippi. He and his fellow students wanted to do something about the racist laws still on the books throughout the South, and after much thought, they agreed on a plan of action. On March 27, 1961, he and eight other students, Meredith Andine, Samuel Bradford, Alfred Cook, Geraldine Edwards, Janice Jackson, Albert Lassiter, Evelyn Pierce, and Ethel Sayer, went into the white-only Jackson Public Library to do research on their school papers. On May 31, 2015, from his home in Southern California, a 78-year-old Joseph Jackson Jr. sat down with From the Vault guest producer Gabrielle San Roman to reflect back on those early days growing up in the South and his efforts to end racial segregation. And we are now proud to present that interview from May 31, 2015.
Now, Mr. Jackson, before we get into the Tougaloo 9 sit-in more than 50 years ago, I want to kind of get into your personal life a little bit. And you weren't born in Jackson, Mississippi. You were actually born in Memphis, Tennessee. So I'm a little curious about your upbringing, racism, and other experiences that shaped your social justice outlook that ultimately motivated you to become a member of the Tougaloo 9 and become a part of the civil rights movement and the history of that movement.
Thanks, Gabriel. My life really began with being born in Memphis, Tennessee on April 14, 1937. Both of my parents were from Mississippi. They came to Memphis, Tennessee in 1937. Growing up in Memphis, Tennessee at that time, you're not aware of the Jim Crow system that you grew up in, meaning only thing you remember is you're with people of your own race. You knew that you went to school, junior high school, elementary, with your classmates. You had your own barber shop, groceries, stores, churches. So it was a community that you grew up in. So you really didn't know that there was a difference in the races of the people until you noticed things were not what you had become accustomed to, meaning when you would go downtown, you would have to get on the bus, and when you got on the bus, then you automatically, I mean, you knew that you would have to go straight to the back. No questions asked, because you were socialized in this system, and it became a matter of habit. Then you noticed when you would go downtown that there were different water fountains. One said white, the other water fountain said colored. And this was the system that I grew up in that helped shape my growth and development. And I did not really realize that this system was known really as a Jim Crow system, and everything that we were taught in that Jim Crow system was that we as Negro people, we weren't called Negroes at that time, was that we were taught in our history books. We were told by our teachers that we were inferior than the white race. And due to the fact that you would always return back to your community, every time you would see a white person, somehow or another, it struck fear within your soul or your psyche, because you knew that that white person was superior than you. It was only until I went to Booker T. Washington High School when our English teacher told us over and over again that the white people may hate the color of our skin, but you get an education, and that is something that they will never ever be able to take away. And the thing that still I have a problem with, especially I know whenever I speak of this, when I was 10 years old, I believe, and I would go during the summer with my mother to visit my grandmother and my great-grandmother in Belzoni, Mississippi. I remembered one summer on our way from Belzoni, Mississippi, coming back to Memphis on the Greyhound bus, the midway stop between Belzoni, Mississippi and Memphis, Tennessee, was called a city, Clarksdale, Mississippi, and that would be the midway point where you would get off and you would go into the colored section for food and whatever. And on our way back to the bus, I don't know what was said, but the Greyhound bus driver, a big, burly, red-faced bus driver, all I saw was him hitting my mother in the face and knocking her down on to the gravel road there. And when I ran to her, her mouth was bleeding. And that just really, really, really reinforced a certain amount of hatred for all white people at that age. And that pretty much added also to the hurt and the pain that I've suffered during those years when I was in school and in Memphis. And my mother, we got back on the Greyhound bus, and as usual, we went to the back. But after graduating from high school, I always remembered what my English teacher told me. And from then on, I vowed to challenge the Jim Crow system of segregation.
Now, you mentioned your teacher saying something that resonated with you in terms of getting an education, and that's something that can't ever be taken away. So that's a nice way to transition to you coming to Mississippi and enrolling in Tougaloo. So what brought you there to Tougaloo College, and how did you get involved with the school's NAACP chapter when you were a student?
I attribute going to Tougaloo to having become ordained after completing my freshman year at Arkansas A&M College in Pine Bluff. I was a minister of the Christian church denomination, the Disciples of Christ. At that time, I had a wife, Clara Wallace Jackson, and I had a daughter that was born there. And as I mentioned earlier, education really was something that I knew that I had to get. And I wrote the missionary board of the Disciple of Christ regarding a ministerial scholarship, if I would be able to be awarded a ministerial scholarship to get on with my education. Well, fortunately, I was awarded a ministerial scholarship to Tougaloo Southern Christian College at that time. Now it's known as Tougaloo College. And I was awarded a ministerial scholarship. And that is what happened. I went to Tougaloo in the spring of 60, and I was awarded a musical scholarship. And so I attended Tougaloo Southern Christian College in the fall of 60. I did not know where Tougaloo was located. I didn't know anything about Tougaloo Southern Christian College. But when I arrived on that campus, I found out by Tougaloo Southern Christian College being a private Christian college, and I found out later that the black movement with regards to civil rights issues, this was the place that you wanted to be with regards to challenging Jim Crow system. The state college, Jackson State College, could not participate in any kind of civil rights activities or demonstrations. So in the fall of 60, I found out that on the campus of Tougaloo College, they had a NAACP youth council there on the campus. I found out that this gentleman named, who was my mentor and my leader, Medgar Wiley Evers, always frequented Tougaloo College, and he always spoke there, and he lived in Jackson, Mississippi, and had become the national field secretary of the state. And so he was the one that called a meeting of those who were really interested in continuing to fight for the rights of our people against the Jim Crow system. And so we had a meeting. This was in September of 1960. The president, Reverend Otis Smith, which I found out from reading the book titled Heroes by Mrs. Merle Evers Williams and Dr. Manning Marble of Columbia University. I bought this book in 05, but I did not know really that Reverend Otis Smith at that time on September the 19th was due to be in court as a result of being involved in a Easter boycott of that spring of 1960. And it just so happened that they voted me. I was 23 years old, and the group of members of the youth council voted me to become president. And I had just gotten there. And that is how I ended up getting to Tougaloo and being involved in the demonstration. And that was the beginning of our meeting with Medgar And Medgar then, at that time, was began formulating a plan, really, for us to go into the segregated all-white library.
Let me jump in here and just remind listeners that I'm speaking with Joseph Jackson Jr. Joseph Jackson Jr. is a living member of the Tougaloo Nine that did a sit-in at the Jackson Public Library on March 27th, 1961. And we're recounting that history. And I do want to segue into the sit-in. Tell our listeners more about how the actual planning of the Tougaloo Nine or the Jackson Public Library sit-in took place.
Well, actually, this was Medgar Evers' plan. From being there on the campus and getting to know Medgar, he was already a man, really, that was committed to bringing about integration in public facilities. He was about trying to integrate the public schools. He was also about trying to not only boycott the businesses in downtown Jackson, but he was also concerned about voters' rights. And so he had already established himself, really, as someone that appeared to have become a threat to the state of Mississippi, especially Jackson, which was the capital. And so when we met, he was the man, he was the one that decided to challenge the public segregated library system. And his plan was for us to go to our Negro library with the inferior books that was known that the George Washington Carver library had. We had to choose books that we knew that the George Washington Carver library did not have. All nine of us really did that. This was Medgar's plan. So when we would walk into the segregated white library, we knew that they had the books that we had chosen to check out from their library. We were told that, knowing that we would get arrested, none of us, knowing that if we were asked whose idea was it or who planned this, who was your leader, we knew that we were not going to say Medgar Evers planned this. And that is how we were able to implement this plan, which really came from Medgar Evers. And we went into the library, and all nine of us, and it was an earth-shattering experience, because you knew that you were challenging the Jim Crow laws of the state of Mississippi by trying to break down these social barriers, and just the thought of entering that library, you really didn't have any time to dwell on being afraid in terms of what you had done. That came later, you know, when we were in the jail cells. But, you know, when we walked into the library, I mean, you know, it was already quiet in the library. But, I mean, it was like on the outside, on our way to the library, you know, we just felt normal. We just felt, you know, to be just like an average college student. But the moment we opened those doors, matter of fact, I saw a small clipping on one of the documentaries on TV. And that's the only clipping, video clip that I have. But it showed three of my colleagues, James, Sammy, Bradford, opening the door to the back entrance of the library and letting Evelyn Pierce and Geraldine Edwards in. We, Albert Lassiter, Alfred Cook, Meredith Anding, Janice Jackson, Ethel Sawyer, and myself, we entered into the front of the library. The moment we stepped in that library, all I know in terms of what I felt when I saw the expressions of those faces on those white people, I mean, it was a hush. I mean, just looking at the expression, they was frightened. They didn't know how to handle it other than to reach for the phone and to call the Jackson Police Department. As a matter of fact, to show you how nervous we were, Ethel Sawyer, I believe, when the police officers came to arrest us, I think she said, really, that she was glad that the police officer didn't look at the book that she was reading because her book had been turned upside down. And then they came in and they asked us to leave. Chief Pierce and his police officers, they gathered around the various tables where we were sitting with our books that we had checked out from the library. And I think they asked us maybe about two or three times that this was an illegal assembly and that if we didn't disperse, we would be arrested. We didn't move, and then they asked us who was our leader. Well, we knew we weren't going to say Medgar Evers was our leader. We just said, we don't have a leader. Well, after that, they told us that we were under arrest for disturbing the peace. And they put us in the paddy wagon and took us to jail.
Did any of the, in the whites only part of the library, I'm wondering, like you said that people were frightened, so they didn't really say anything hateful towards you while you were there. How long was it before the police arrested you? Did the whole sit-in last? And then you said you're arrested for disturbing the peace. How long did the Jackson Police Department hold you? And then tell me about that time in jail for the period of time that you spent for the sit-in.
You know, when we entered that library, everyone really, for the most part, really were in a state of shock because you have to remember that this was the first time in Jackson's history that Negroes really had ever entered their segregated all-white public library. And so when we walked in, no one came over to us, especially the white students, whoever were in there. No one, it was just, they were speechless. And they just couldn't believe what was happening. And with us, you know what I mean? Once we got our books, we just sat really, you know, steadfastly in the chairs and just was looking in the books, you know, and we didn't really have any idea in terms of how long we were there before the police officers came. That was not our focus. We knew that they were coming. I mean, but one of my colleagues said that really, while waiting for the police to get there, one of my colleagues said they were glad that they got there because that relieved the pressure on them. And I was glad that they came, because just being there and knowing what you've just done, and nobody is talking, and it's just silence, and everybody's waiting for the police to come to take you away. That is exactly what happened. No one said any racial slurs or any derogatory names at all. It was just that experience for both races.
And again, the name of the drama is Freedom.
You are listening to an interview with Joseph Jackson Jr., who together with 8 fellow students were known as the Tupelo Nine and made national headlines when they broke the Jim Crow law by entering the white-only Maine Public Library in Jackson, Mississippi. This is From the Vault Radio. For a copy of this program, you can go to fromthevaultradio.org or call us in the archives toll-free at 1-800-735-0230. To browse our entire collection of over 50,000 recordings, go to pacificaradioarchives.org. And now back to our program and Gabrielle San Ramon.
And so when they took us to jail it was a different story because, I mean, here we are in the paddy wagon, and that's when, you know, your mind is telling you, now look what you've done. You know what's going to happen to you when they lock you up in those jails. That's what went through my mind. I had a script. Matter of fact, when they put us in jail and they booked us and everything, at the beginning they put the four female ladies in one cell together, and 5 of us in another cell. That was prior to booking us and prior to interrogating us regarding what we had done. So they, after they had booked us, then they separated us. And I was in the cell with Abbott Lassiter and Meredith Anding, and they put James Sammy Bradford and Alfred Cook in another cell, and I don't know about the females. I know they separated us, and then that's when they took each one of us at a time, the females and then the males at a time, and they interrogated us about, you know, why we did it, who was the leader, and et cetera. My thing was, we knew, really, that according to Medgar Evers, we knew that we would be released from jail. It was in the afternoon. Excuse me. We knew that with confidence that we would be released from jail at least about 7 or 7:30 that night. I think it was that Monday night, because the NAACP had posted bond with the Jackson Police Department. So we knew we was going to be out. Well, that did not happen. And the later it got, that was when I really became frightened. And my script was, if they came in there and got me, because knowing that system, and reflecting back on Emmett Till and what happened to him, and the historical history of lynching that's connected with Mississippi, the lady it got that night, I was in fear of my life. And my mind said, well, if they come for you, brother, you better have a script ready that may cause them or the Klan to change their minds about taking you out into a field and hanging you, because you know that's what they're going to do. And so my script was, if they came in to get me, I was going to fall on bended knees and plead with them, like, please, Mr. Klansman, don't hang me. I have a wife and two little children in Memphis, Tennessee. And if you release me this night, I promise you that I will never, ever come back here to Jackson, Mississippi and violate your Jim Crow laws. I think one of my colleagues said, well, that sounds very good, but you know what the Klansman would say? Nigger, you should have thought about that before you entered our segregated public library. I mean, that whole night went by, and the late it got, and then over into Tuesday morning, I mean, I was just really just frightened, just with fear. We were not released until later that Tuesday evening. Now, what was even more frightening, reading in the 2005 book titled The Hero, the writings, the speeches and the letters of Medgar Evers, I didn't know what time it was, because I knew it was a long time in jail. And I had just found out from reading Medgar's account of what happened. Sheriff Guilfoy, at that time, according to what was written in that book, had the bond money on Monday, but he refused to release us and made himself unavailable that Monday to prevent him from releasing us out on bond. And when I read that in 05, I said, that's what I was feeling, because sheriffs or those in law enforcement have been known, and to leave the keys there in the jail for anybody, a mob, to come in. And I felt that, but I didn't find out why it took so long for us to have been released until I read that in that book. And when we were released, there was jubilation when we got back to the campus of Tougaloo. I mean, really, they called us the Mississippi Pioneers. Reverend John Mangrum, one of the professors of religion, who was our advisor of the NAACP Youth Council, called us pioneers, Mississippi pioneers. Everybody really was proud of our courage and our determination to be able to challenge the system. And so there again, you know, we've got to go to court on this matter. And that particular day when we were taken to Hines courthouse, I would say there were a large a crowd of Negroes just waving their hands and smiling and just so proud of us when we got out of the cars to go up the steps leading into the courthouse. I don't know what happened outside, but you know, I've always kept archival information of that incident, and I have an archival piece from the newspaper, the Jackson newspaper, called The Patriot. And the article, in bold letters, the topic was, Jackson reaches a turning point. And there were approximately 100 Negroes standing outside screaming. They were happy to see the students from Tougaloo enter into the courtroom. And further down, I read that the Jackson police officers were unable to really maintain control of that crowd. And, you know, we only know of the dogs, you know, that was biting the Negroes there in Birmingham. You know, that was on national TV, you know. But people don't know that they had German Shepherd dogs at that time in 1961. And some of our people were threatened to be bitten by these dogs, and my leader and my mentor was really caught in the midst of the riot to the point where he was hit over the head by a police officer with his pistol. And this was what was written in this archival newspaper. Well, when we entered into the courthouse facing the judge, judge told us that we were charged with disturbing the peace, all nine of us, and that we would be fined $100 each, provided that we would not participate in any other acts of civil disobedience. Because if we did, if we were involved, if we involved ourselves in future civil rights demonstration, then the suspended sentence would be rescinded, and the next step would be what happened to the Freedom Riders the following month when they rode into Jackson in May. We would be sent to Parchman State Penitentiary. We, of course, did not participate in any other civil rights demonstrations. We had support from Jackson State College. I think it was about 15 college students rallied on our behalf. College president told the students that Jackson State College was a state college and that it did not want any of the students to be involved in going down to the courthouse or being involved in any kind of gathering. And I think about 15 of Jackson State College students disobeyed, and they went on down to the courthouse anyway. And for as my knowledge is concerned, they were suspended. When we got back to the campus and everything, I finished my sophomore year there, of 1960, I returned back to the fall of 60, and I was a philosophy and religion major. And in the spring of 60, right at the end of the fall semester, when it was ending, my son, Joseph M. Jackson, the third, was a year and 3 months old, became very, very ill. He had a very serious virus. My wife, Clara, wrote me a letter and said that she was really trying to make ends meet and trying to take care of the medical bills, but she no longer could hang on, and therefore I had to come home, had to come back to Memphis, and that's how it all ended for me at Tougaloo in the spring of 1962.
Now I want to remind our listeners that I am speaking with Joseph Jackson Jr., one of the Tougaloo Nine, who sat in a segregated library, the Jackson Public Library, on March 27th, 1961. And we're here talking about that history. Now, you have a deep reverence for your mentor, Medgar Evers, and you did have to leave Jackson, you did have to leave Tougaloo to care for your sick child. But I'm wondering where you were when you got the news of Evers' assassination, and what thoughts and feelings and emotions were going through your head at that time of that terrible news?
Well, I was at home in Memphis when I heard that he was assassinated on June 12th, sometime past midnight. And I don't know, I still have some bitterness during that time, primarily because, you know, I have to give it to Bob Dylan, who wrote the song A Pawn in the Game, regarding Byron D. LeBeckwith being used as a pawn by the wealthy plantation owners in Mississippi. And he allowed himself to be a pawn to assassinate my leader. But witnessing the March on Washington on August the 28th of that same year, and knowing that Medgar should have been there making his speech on behalf of his constituency in Jackson, Mississippi, and realizing that he was assassinated in June, and I would say about 2 months later, my leader and my mentor was no longer there to be present there at the March on Washington. And it's very painful right now for me to really have those thoughts, because he was a courageous man when he had the opportunity to leave that state, which is known as a closed society. Those are my thoughts.
And going back to the sit-in of Jackson Public Library in 1961, you yourself had been, it took until about the 50th anniversary, correct, of the sit-in itself before the historical significance of your own action came back into your life. So I want to ask about, why did that happen, that disconnect? So tell us about that, as you know, winding down the story, how Tougaloo is finally coming back around again, not just in your life personally, but more people are going to learn about the sit-in, about what you did. And it's going to take on a second, it'll have a rebirth of history. So when did it start coming back, and how do you feel about its rebirth of history?
It would just so happen that I was watching a documentary called The Last White Night, and it was about my son. It was 2013, December, and my son said, "Daddy," he said, "there's a documentary of a man that's interviewing Byron D. LeBeckwith Jr. And he was involved in the Freedom Summer event, and he mentioned Medgar Evers." He said, "I don't know whether or not that show is going to re-air, but if it does, I'm going to record it for you." Well, this was like December of 2013. It re-aired. It was the last program that re-aired, I think, in January 2014. And it was at that time that I saw the annual Medgar Evers Parade. And I said, "Oh, I've got to go to Jackson. I've got to really, really get this image out of my head." Because when I left Tougaloo, I'm just aware of nothing but the segregated system. And I've got to really participate in my leader's parade. Well, that's how I found out about the Medgar Evers Parade. And it was going to be on June 7th, that Saturday. Me and my son flew on United Airlines from California, and we arrived in Jackson, Mississippi, about 8 a.m. that morning. And here is really the clincher. We checked into the Holiday Inn Express Hotel, and that hotel is just about 5 minutes from the campus of Tougaloo College. And just knowing now, I was a part of seeing the changes that had taken place in Mississippi to be able to live in an integrated hotel here on June 6th here in 2014, whereas I knew that 53 years prior, that was non-existent. And so on that Saturday, well, not only that, that Friday I met Charles Evers at his radio station, Medgar's oldest brother. He was 91 years old last year. God bless his soul. We went to the banquet, the Medgar Evers Foundation banquet that they give out scholarship. It was just so happened that Merle Evers Williams was there presenting an award to a prominent doctor who was a friend of Medgar's, and I saw Rena, Medgar's only daughter, there at the banquet. We took pictures and everything, and I'm sitting there at the table with four other ladies, and I'm sharing my history, and one of the ladies said, "Oh yes, I remember the trial, because I attended your trial on that day." And I said, "Oh, wow." And so that was an unusual experience for me to be back. And then that Saturday, me and my son, we met there at Freedom Corner. Freedom Corner is an intersection of Martin Luther King Boulevard and Mega Wiley Evers Avenue. They call that Freedom Corner. And me and my son, they have a statue of Medgar and Martin there, right there on Freedom Corner. And me and my son took pictures standing in front of it. And then we were in the parade. And so that's how I became reconnected with our history as being a part of the Tougaloo Nine. I don't know when the term Tougaloo Nine really was coined, but, you know, that's what we are called now. And so that was in June 6th and 7th, and the greatest honor that I could have ever received was when Debbie Fierce, through our email contact, who is the executive director of the Jackson Hines Library System, sent me a letter and sent letters to the other Tougaloo Nine, inviting us to attend a celebration of the Tougaloo Nine on August the 28th, 2014, and that we would receive a medallion with our names engraved on the back and with the emblem of the Jackson Hines County Library emblem on the front. And she said that we will also receive a DVD copy of the reenactment of our read-in demonstration being reenacted by nine of the young librarians, the aides who work for the library. They are going to reenact our demonstration, and we would have a DVD commemorating that event. Although I couldn't make it because, you know, I have glaucoma, and I wrote and told her, you know, the reason why I would be unable to make it. And she sent me my medallion and a copy of the DVD in the mail. And that's how I became connected again to the history of the Tougaloo Nine. I mean, it was you call it fate, the Zeitgeist, destiny, whatever you want to call it. All I know, you know, it happened, and then now here you are. You know what I mean? So I, you know, this is an awe-inspiring moment for me, and I have no control over what really has transpired with regards to the history of the civil rights history of the Tougaloo Nine.
Well, on that note, thank you for your actions that day on March 27, 1961, and also thank you very much for sharing your story and your struggle with our listeners here today.
My pleasure.
And that does it for this week's From the Vault. We want to give a special thanks to From the Vault guest producer Gabriel San Roman, who is also the author of Venceremos, Victor Jara and the New Chilean Song Movement, co-creator of the 2015 calendar of Revolt, and a writer with the OC Weekly. For a copy of this program or programs in this series, visit us online at pacificaradioarchives.org or call us toll-free in the